shoot, they score!
Score!
We have put the coffee!
Hit the shot, it's good!
This week in the NHL.
I felt like I did all the right things to prepare for this game.
We got to be focused all 60 minutes.
This week in the NHL.
The most arrogant team he's ever played against.
Do you think it's more of a personnel issue or more of a
scheme? He's dominating like the Jets wanted him to do.
This is NHL This Week with the Illegal Curve. Now, Drew Mandel, Ezra Ginsberg, and Richard Pollock on your home of the Winnipeg Jets and all things hockey. TSN 1290. TSN1290.ca.
Wednesday evening, the 11th of November, is solemn and dignified Remembrance Day, as it always should be, as we remember those who've given their all for our country so that we can live in peace and tranquility. Good evening and welcome to NHL This Week. Drew Mandel alongside Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/illegalcurve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets news is illegalcurve.com. 2 hours of hockey talk for you on this Wednesday evening. We'll start by looking back last night's Jets Wild game, a contest that was as close as it could be after 20 minutes, 1-1. Pretty reasonable first period, I thought, from both sides. Jets had some momentum, the Wild had some momentum, and then in a blink of an eye, in the blink of a second period, in the blink of a 10 minutes in the second period, the Winnipeg Jets fall apart, the Minnesota Wild take advantage, and the window dressing in the third period notwithstanding, the Minnesota Wild win a key Central Division matchup fairly handily by a 5-3 margin, which I think flattered the Winnipeg Jets. Good evening, gentlemen. First of all, I say to both of you, nice to see you both.
Yeah, good evening, guys. You know, it was a very disappointing game, Drew, coming off a very disappointing loss to the Philadelphia Flyers where they were shut out. And this Minnesota Wild team is a good team. We know that. But the way that the Winnipeg Jets played was not good enough. And I think you really heard that from the Winnipeg Jets. They sounded like a very disappointed group. And you get down to a team like the Minnesota Wild 5-1, it's tough to come back. It's tough to come back against any team 5-1, but I think it's the way that the Jets have played these last five games. They've only won one game here in November, and the way they've been playing defensively just isn't good enough, guys. And, you know, it's not Andrei Pavlik's fault. He gets pulled after four goals, similar to the way he gets pulled in the Montreal game. To me, there were parallels between the Montreal game and the Minnesota game.
Hutchinson was in net for during the Montreal game, though.
Yes.
Yeah, that's what you meant.
But parallels in the same sense that they gave up five goals in that game and the goaltender was pulled after four goals, right, Drew? In this case, you know, Andrei Pavlik, he doesn't have a chance on the Eric Halla goal. He doesn't have a chance on the two Thomas Vanek goals. I mean, The way the Jets have been giving up goals, I think, is troubling. And I think Paul Maurice, Charlie Huddy, the entire coaching staff must have been working on that at practice this morning. And you saw Ben Chiarot go back into the regular kind of pairings there, and Mark Stewart paired up again with Jacob Trouba. It's just not acceptable. And after 16 games here, it's looking a lot more tight than it was after the first five games, after it was after the first 10 games, meaning that we know that only five teams are going to get in the Central. The Hawks are in sixth right now, only 1 point behind the Jets. But
Duncan Keith coming back.
Duncan Keith is coming back. Mm-hmm. The Predators keep winning. The Blues shut out the Devils last night. It's not going to get easier. So tomorrow's game against Dallas is huge. And I know the narrative, Drew, going into last night's game was, is this a defining road trip? I tend to believe that there aren't one or two defining games. I think there are several defining moments in a season.
I agree
with
that.
But in the first part of the season, Richie, this is a defining game because you've lost your last two games. As I mentioned, you've only won one of your last five. This is the first slump of the season for the Jets. The Jets started off with a bang. Sure. They won four of their first five games. They were looking good. Looked good on the road, but they got to clean up their defensive play. And, you know, for all of the goals that they got in the third period, making it interesting, they almost made it 5-4, if you remember. Yeah. But, I mean, you just can't gift four goals to the Minnesota Wild early on and expect to win games.
You mentioned those teams, Ezzy. Also, the thing is, the Jets have been very fortunate with the injury bug. I mean,
You know, St. Louis has lost Jaden Schwartz for months.
Sure.
Kevin Shattenkirk has missed a large amount of games. Duncan Keith, arguably the best defenseman in the league. I mean, I think Drew Doughty is, but he's up there. He's missed many games, and you could see the loss and the effect that it had on the Blackhawks when they were in Winnipeg. I mean, they had 40-plus shots, but the transition game was with Svedberg wasn't the same as it obviously would have been with Duncan Keith. And you look at Minnesota last night, missing Zach Parise, and the first time the Jets met the Wild, arguably he was their best player. So there's that factor as well. As he makes a lot of good points there, I mean, there are things to be concerned about. One of the things to be concerned about to me last night was that every defensive pairing got scored against, and it wasn't like one pairing was the issue. So I realize, and we'll talk about it, that Paul Maurice in practice reverted back to the old pairings. But you have Dustin Byfuglien on the power play getting beat. You have Trouba and Myers not knowing which guy is which guy. You have that issue. You have Postma being undressed. So every pairing is vulnerable. That's a problem if you're a coach, because you can say, okay, you know, this pairing is be a problem. We need to address that. Last night, all the pairings were a problem, and I realize he's trying to address all three, which by reverting back to the three he had originally, you'd say, well, why did you change from those in the first place? So that's a question to address. I think another thing is, clearly, the Wild had a scouting report. I thought that was very evident yesterday, that the Jets defensemen are very aggressive and like to create offense and like to pinch down the boards and like to join the rush all the time. Sure. Because if you saw the play, and Shane and Dennis talked about it on the television broadcast, Vanek left the zone as soon as he saw the opportunity. Hollo, the same thing. So there obviously is a scouting report there. Because, hey, let me tell you something. If you're playing for Mike Yeo and you're cheating the zone like that, and it's not part of a report, you're going to be sitting on the bench.
The report, I mean, which basically is, get, you know, the defenseman's going to attack you at the offensive blue line. Get the puck past him, and you're going to have an odd man break, or you're going to have a breakaway like we saw in both of those.
Well, if you saw the plays there, Drew, what happened was the Jets' focus was on the puck.
Sure.
And, I mean, the biggest thing as a defense was make sure nobody gets behind you. And if they get behind you, you're sure as heck better to stop the puck before it gets to that guy.
How do you get behind you when you're on a delayed penalty call coming to you at the same time? I mean, it's, you know, why are you pushing the play at that point in time? Because there's no benefit. It's not like you can create offense. The puck is, the whistle is going to be blown as soon as you touch the puck.
So, I mean, these are issues that the Jets have to address. I thought, obviously, their second period, as I think, was the worst period of the year. That was pretty obvious.
Well, either that or the first period against Montreal going back, you know, 10
days yesterday
or so.
More because it's an intra-division game.
And there's no, I mean, the Montreal, you can give it an excuse about the back-to-back. You have a lot of built-in excuses for the Montreal that you'd won the night before. This was a game where you're coming off of a stinker at home against the Philadelphia Flyers, a game that was, I mean, horrendous. You know, we were there. It was an awful game, of course, to observe. And you think, okay, you know, maybe that game against Philadelphia, maybe that's a blessing in disguise, that loss, gets you some energy, sort of recalibrates yourself going forward. But then you go on into Minnesota, you know, you have a large contingent of Jets fans there, as per usual. And again, you have a good first period, but then you just fall asleep for 10 minutes. These just seem like mental lapses that I don't know that we...
I thought that was more than falling asleep for 10 minutes.
Go on.
I mean... You allowed breakaways and chances that don't usually happen in any NHL games anymore.
I think to Richie's point, there's a
few...
Are they
scheme issues?
No, I don't think they're scheme issues. I think it's a total awareness and confidence issues that were coming to play there and team buy-in on defense. And as I want to hear what you have to say there. But if you remember before the season or just after the season started, we said on this show, it's not a question. I know they've struggled goal scoring lately. It's not a question of can they score this year.
Mm-hmm.
This year, the question is, can they defend? We said that a month and a half ago. And the answer as of now is no. Because the problem, Ezzy, is that the goaltenders bailed them out for the first month and a bit of the season. The goaltenders aren't playing lights out right now. The Jets are becoming vulnerable.
The 25th in the league in goals against, with 46 goals given up, you know, with Edmonton, Toronto, Ottawa, Columbus, and Calgary. Those aren't playoff teams.
And I think the issue here is that the new style that the Jets are playing, it's not completely different, but with the players that they've brought in, a lot of young players, you're talking about Nikolaj Ehlers, and you're talking about Andrew Kopp and Alexander Burmistrov, is their defense good enough to allow them to play the way that they're playing? That's the issue to me, because they've opened it up a little bit. They're more offensive team this year. They're still a physical team in many regards. They're still one of the biggest teams, if not the biggest team in the NHL. But the way they've opened it up, taking chances, I mean, they have a lot of guys that like to jump up into the play on the blue line, Drew. You've got Myers, you've got Trouba, you've got Buff. I mean, even Mark Stewart lately has been jumping up into the play, even though he's a stay-at-home guy. But the way that they have decided to employ and kind of the makeup of their team, I think it's running into issues. And Richie's right. In the first five or six games of the year, I think the goaltending was making up for some of that gambling. But what we've seen is they need to get back to that defensive structure that led to so much success last year. That allowed them to go into rinks like the United Center, Drew, and beat the Chicago Blackhawks, shut down teams. They've got to get back to that. If your defensive structure isn't there, if you're not playing well defensively, you can score three or four goals a night and you're going to lose. And that's what we've seen. The offense, I agree with Richie, it's not a problem. And you've got Blake Wheeler, who's, what, third or fourth in the league in scoring right now. Brian Little, he's going pretty well right now. Andrew Ladd, no problem with the way he's playing. Maybe Scheifele, Ehlers, Perreault, they've cooled down a little bit. But that line has been their best offensive line for the majority of the season. So I can understand why Paul Maurice at practice today had Thorburn up on the third line. I know we're going to get into that later, but I can understand he's going to move some pieces around. And Burmistrov, he's got to stop taking so many penalties. I like the way Burmistrov has played here the last couple of weeks, but the penalties have got to stop. He's taken seven minor penalties now. I can understand why he's going back down to the fourth line, but the point being, they've got to correct the way they're playing defensively. And that's not just the six starting defensemen. It's the entire team.
But that's a good point, because it is the entire team.
Mm-hmm.
But it certainly helps when your defensemen are able to defend.
Yeah, I mean,
like Paul Postma, again, he's going to be coming out of the lineup here likely, but you got to be able to defend one-on-one there.
Well, I mean, it's textbook. I mean, that's not a...
But he's not the only one, Drew.
No, he's certainly not the only one. You can't blame him individually for all the problems. But, I mean, on that play, I mean, you don't see NHL defensemen being undressed on that play very often. Because you know what your responsibility is. Your responsibility is just to stare at Thomas Vanek right in the chest and hit him.
Right, and it's unfortunate for Paul Postma.
Let him come to you and hit him.
It's unfortunate for Postma. Let's be honest. Thomas Vanek's a pretty good goal scorer.
Yeah, but
he looked great yesterday.
But I know Postma, it was a play, Drew, where you got to lay the body. I mean, if you're a defenseman, you got to lay the body. You got to stand up there.
He's not a physical guy, as you know that.
He's not the most physical guy, but again, we can't just pick on Paul Postma.
And I agree with you.
Because we can pick on all six defensemen.
I agree with Ezzy here, because you drop a guy in there, hasn't played much. He's going to have some mistakes as part of his game.
Yeah.
It's already 3-1 at that point.
I think there's certainly a debate at this point in his career, you know, is Paul Postma ever going to be an NHL regular?
Sure, they keep signing him, so I mean...
Yeah, the Jets seem to want to keep him around, and that's their business. I don't see it, but again...
Somebody who's battled confidence problems. It's tough to be a guy with confidence problems who doesn't play a lot, and then when you play, you make mistakes.
Yeah.
And when you play with Mark Stewart.
Which has certainly been a problem
been challenging
to start
guys,
this
year.
And I think you've seen that problem with Jacob Trouba to some extent as well, and that to some extent...
Yeah, they're reverting back to it after a fairly quick experiment. And that goes back to the left, the right side thing that we've talked about for 2-3 years, 4 years. I mean, really since Trouba came up.
No, you got too many left side defensemen. That's
right
or
side.
You got right side defensemen, and not enough left. I mean, it's pretty obvious. That's all okay.
I think people are realizing. It was a small amount of games, but I think people are realizing how difficult it is for the right side guy to play the other side, and how much it changes your angles.
Well, you're giving up on it really after two games.
I appreciate that, Drew. But this is my. I want to say this before we go to break here. We talked at length about, and this is obvious, about their strength, their overabundance of right-handed guys who can play big minutes. But if you are absolutely committed to that plan, you have to start that from exhibition season through to the first 10 games. When you drop it in the middle of the season, every game matters, and as he pointed out, five teams are making the playoffs likely out of this division, and there's going to be six teams that are going to have an awful lot of points. It's tough to start experimenting in the 10 to 20 game range.
And I think that probably shows you how desperate Paul Maurice felt he was getting.
Was he desperate? Was their record desperate when he decided to go to it?
Well, he saw warning signs. I don't think at that point in time the record wasn't desperate, but he obviously felt that. I wonder to some extent, was it just an effort to get Jacob Trouba going?
Maybe, but you see, again, it's that right-left thing. It's not as easy as some people think it is.
No, certainly not. I mean, we haven't seen it work in Winnipeg yet. They tried it with Zach Bogosian a number of years ago when Jacob Trouba's rookie year. Remember, they started that season with Bogosian playing the left side.
They did it sparingly, but I mean, if you thought it was going to work, you would have seen it earlier, you think. So then to do it now is a difficult thing. And I mean, remember, Postma and Myers, to me, from what I can tell and what I know, are probably the two guys who are the most fragile confidence-wise of the seven.
Mm-hmm. Let's head to break. When we come back, we'll talk more about the defense. They've been shuffled. We'll talk about the forward group. That's been shuffled as well. And we'll continue discussing the penalties. You're listening to NHL This Week. We're live on TSN 1290.
Finding my game and kind of getting into a groove, finding my confidence. It's been a bit of a battle here my first full year. So just getting back to my game and keeping things simple and just doing the little things right, winning battles and playing well.
Winnipeg Jets defenseman Ben Chiarot will be back in the lineup tomorrow night as the Jets and the Dallas Stars play in the Lone Star State. Welcome back to NHL This Week. This segment brought to you by Linden Market Dental Center, official dentist of Illegal Curve Hockey. Whether an elite athlete or a weekend warrior, a proper fitting custom-made mouth guard is a must-have piece of protective equipment. Don't be an Ezzy. Give yourself peace of mind protection as well as facial, teeth, and mouth protection. Contact the Linden Market Dental Center, 204-487-2226, or online at lindenmarketdentalcenter.com. As we mentioned in the opening segment off the top of the program, new defense pairings going into tomorrow's game. What was once old is now new again, with Toby Enstrom and Dustin Byfuglien being back together. Mark Stewart and Jacob Trouba, and Ben Chiarot comes back into the lineup, and he's going to play with Tyler Myers, a pairing we saw earlier this season. Let's start with the defense before we get to the forwards. Are you surprised that the Trouba-Myers experiment only lasted the two games?
No, I'm not, because I didn't think they were very good together. So, you know, Drew, you mentioned at the top of the segment what's old is new again, and we've seen all of these pairings before. Mark Stewart and Jacob Trouba have played together for the last 3 years. Since he came into the NHL, they've played together. So that's not a new combo. Chiarot and Myers were playing together earlier in the season, and Enstrom and Byfuglien we've seen since the first year the Jets were back, right? So none of these are new. They're new based on the last two games where Paul Postma was in the lineup playing on that third pair with Mark Stewart. But to me, guys, it comes down to the top two pairs there. Tobias Enstrom and Dustin Byfuglien haven't been good enough defensively. And to me, I still have an issue with that pairing, because to me, the best pairing over the last couple of years has been Enstrom with Myers. And I don't know why Paul Maurice insists on not having Myers with Enstrom. Well, I can actually think of a few reasons. I know why he's doing it, but I would think that if the defense doesn't play well through the course of this road trip, I wouldn't be surprised if Myers goes back to that top pair. And the reason why I say that is because I believe that on this team, with the exception of Mark Stewart, who has the ability to shut down defensively, I think Tyler Myers is the best pure shutdown defenseman along with Jacob Trouba. So if you're not going to have him on that top pair, and that doesn't mean that he doesn't get assignments, because against this Dallas Stars team, they have three lines that can score. And even Vern Fiddler scored yesterday versus the Toronto Maple Leafs, even though they lost.
Their top line's the best line in hockey.
It's the best line. So you're going to have Tobias Enstrom and Dustin Byfuglien against the best line in hockey. Okay? Mm-hmm. I mean, Jamie Benn and Tyler Seguin, I mean, it's ridiculous. These guys it's the best duo in the league. So those two guys as the top pair, we know what they can do offensively, but they've been struggling defensively. So to me, that's where it begins, Drew. And yes, when you look at these D pairings, they have some work to do. But it's also the time allotment, the amount of time they're getting, and the way they're playing as a unit. And, you know, Ben Chiarot, I actually didn't think was that bad against Ottawa. Obviously, he got into the doghouse with Paul Maurice there in the third period. But as a guy who is with Tyler Myers, that goes to Richie's point, you know, talking about Paul Postma and his confidence issues, I think right now, to me, that's the issue that I have. I think that the top pairs for the Jets are struggling in those shutdown roles, and I realize that Jacob Trouba is also not producing offensively, but I don't think Jacob Trouba can be your third-pairing defenseman, Richie. I just don't see it.
It's chicken or the egg, right? I mean, is Jacob Trouba struggling because he's playing kind of third-pairing minutes, or he's playing, to me, deployed as a third-pairing defenseman? Or is he being deployed as a third-pairing defenseman because he's playing like a third-pairing? Yeah, is he struggling? I mean, that's something that you could see there's a bit of a confidence issue there. And does playing him with Mark Stewart and a comfort level allow him to revert to old form? Maybe. Is that a deeper problem? Is it a contract issue? Is he thinking about the pending restricted free agency? Is that an issue? I mean, that's a thing that coaching staff has to get at.
Why has he been struggling?
Why has he been struggling? Because the height of his game last year, I thought mid-season, he was as good a shutdown defenseman as I was watching.
When the Jets had a ton of injuries on the back end and he was playing significant minutes.
He was completely snuffing out scoring chances against the other team, top players with confidence. I mean, I don't think he's ever going to be the offensive defenseman. Maybe some others think he's going to be that. They don't really need him to be. Let me tell you, with all the offense they have, they don't need him to be. They need him to be a defensively solid defenseman. And especially out of their core. I mean, you have Buffen, you have Enstrom, we talked about that. You have Myers. All these guys move the puck. Mm-hmm. I mean, are they shut down Scotty Stevens, Scott Niedermeyer kind of guys, as you know? But you need to obviously be able to move the puck. You need to be able to defend. And this is kind of, I mean, we can rehash and we can analyze based on the current personnel. But let's be honest here. This has been a problem since the Jets came back to Winnipeg. The team that they got, are they more offensively inclined and not able to defend? And has that kind of been the problem? Well,
you thought that problem was solved, though, last season with how defensively responsible they were.
Absolutely.
Now I don't know if Paul Maurice has loosened the strings on that.
I mean, do any of us, I realize that they're going to be able to generate scoring chances, but do any of us trust Buffen and Enstrom in a key defensive situation?
No.
Because, I mean, that's, what, 10, 11 plus million bucks. Okay? So then who are you paying instead of those guys to trust in a big defensive situation? Are you paying Myers and blank player?
Well, you know, that's why I'm surprised that you're not, you know, once we're back shuffling the defense, why not go back to what worked best sort of towards the middle to the end of last year? Ben Sherrod and Dustin Byfuglien and Toby Enstrom and Tyler Myers. I mean, I don't know why we haven't seen those players back together.
I mean, I tossed out a couple weeks ago when we were talking about shuffling it before they actually did the shuffle, was Enstrom and Trouba.
Sure, I'd like to see that as well. But again, because you've never really seen that.
Right, and so I thought maybe that would be something to shuffle up.
But if you're looking for confidence, you got benched. I mean, you have a problem on your left side, in that you have, you know, you need a third pairing left side defenseman who's got confidence. Right now, you don't have that.
You need a second. Well, simplify. You need a second pairing left side defenseman.
Fine, second or third. You know, it's whatever you want to call Stewart at this point in time.
No, he's not a second pairing.
I know he's not a second pairing, but I mean, you need somebody to play with, you know, with either Myers or with Byfuglien.
You also need a left side defenseman who can shoot.
Sure. You do. But, I mean, I don't know why you haven't seen Sherrod. Sherrod and Byfuglien were good together. They weren't
world
beaters.
And they were good together. They were good. They had some strengths together because Sherrod just deferred to Byfuglien, said, just you play the puck. I'll get you the puck.
Why not do that again? What's the downside? Why haven't we seen that again this season when right now this team looks a little discombobulated defensively? And it's not just the defense, it's the forwards as well.
Well, that's for sure, Drew. I mean, Pomeroy spoke about cheating, and that's true.
Yeah, I just don't know why we haven't seen that, you know, go back.
Does that solve all the problems?
No, I don't think it solves all the problems.
We're going to talk about the penalty problem. We're going to talk about the forward lines first. Do you want to?
Yeah, okay, let's rehash the new forward lines as we enter into tomorrow's game against you've seen a shuffling on the bottom two forward groups, the bottom six, as it were. You have Thorburn, Lowry, and Stafford.
Yesterday you saw Perreault and Ladd flip, but I think they went back to the regular.
They went
lines
back, yeah. Ladd, Little, Wheeler, and Perreault, Scheifele, and Ehlers, that's staying the same. What you've seen is a switch on the third, fourth lines. Thorburn, Lowry, Stafford, Burmistrov, Kopp, and Patan.
I mean, what's the third and fourth line there is my first question.
I don't think it necessarily matters that much.
I mean, Lowry hasn't scored a goal, and Thorburn can't score.
And Stafford hasn't scored in
right, but
seven
Stafford's
games or something.
Right, but Stafford's a talented goal scorer. It's just you're playing with two guys who aren't going to be getting the puck, right, Ezzy? So, I mean, is that your third line?
Well, I think what's happening here, there's a few moves in that third and fourth line here, Drew. Thorburn's moving to the other wing, and then obviously Stafford's moving back to the left wing. Patan is moving from the left wing to the right wing, right? Kopp staying in the middle. But I think what you're trying to do here is you're trying to get more consistency out of the bottom lines. It's pretty simple. I don't think it's more than that. I think, you know, to your point, Rich, I think, you know, with Lowry and Thorburn and Stafford, I mean, you're going to have, I think, a similar type of output. Burmistrov, even though, you know, he has more offensive ability than Chris Thorburn, you know, right now he's not showing it, and he's taking too many penalties. For me, he's
yes,
in the doghouse.
You're right.
And I realize he got out of the penthouse, Drew, for about an hour.
Got into the penthouse.
Getting that Toronto goal.
Yeah.
Against Toronto, I should say.
The game winner,
I mean, this is an issue here. They got to be better defensively. And Adam Lowry's done a great job as a shutdown center. I mean, on the first goal, him and Trouba have a little miscommunication, and that leads to the goal. I mean, there was a, if you remember the goal.
Yeah, that's more on defenseman than Lowry. Lowry got beat off the wall.
Right, he got beat off, yeah. Niederreiter was, you know, in front of the net, and Trouba wasn't able to cover him because Myers was covering another forward. But this is the point here. The lines, whether the forward lines or the defense lines, when the team is not doing well, it's not uncommon for any team in the NHL or at any level of hockey to move the lines around. Right. So you're going to see that quite a bit, Drew.
Sure.
And to your point earlier about the defenseman, I know we're on the forwards here, but I wouldn't be surprised if you go back to Tobias Enstrom and Tyler Myers, if you go back to Bencherot and Dustin Byfuglien, it's the same six defensemen as finished the season last year. So with the exception of Paul Postma or Adam Party coming in, it's the same group here.
Yeah.
It's not like you have a rookie or anything like that. It's the same group. You know, Sherrod is second year in the NHL and Trouba's third year in the NHL.
There's no growing pains, though.
Aside from that, it's a veteran group of defensemen here, and they got to get it going. As far as the forwards go, I mean, like I said last segment, in the top two lines have been producing. Nikolai Ehlers is
a second line hasn't in a while. Well, but they have over the course of the year.
They've been getting their chances, even in the Toronto and Ottawa games, where you'd like to have seen a more consistent effort, or the Philadelphia game. I mean, Scheifele and Ehlers have been getting their chances. And at the end of the day, chances don't get you wins. You got to get goals. But the point being, I'm not worried about the top six here. It's more so what's going on in the bottom six forwards here. And I realize Kopp, you know, missed four games, Richie, and, you know.
But he's not going to be the scoring alternative.
No, I'm just saying. I mean, there's been a little, you know, turnover with Peluso going in and Cormier going in against Philadelphia.
You need a shutdown defensive forward line?
No.
Well, that's been the Lowry line so far.
I mean, I don't
but
think
Stafford's
need
not built in that
they're
role.
Telling, are they saying these this day and age that you need nine forwards, three scoring lines who can kind of do both, okay? So you need some goals from that line. Forget the defensive shutdown stuff. You need some goals. But to me, when I look at the new lines, I just see a bunch of guys out of position. Stafford and Thorburn, both right wingers on the same line. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Bermistrov and
Patan.
Well,
that's not going to stay together. I mean, I don't see that staying
likely
together.
It doesn't, but Bermistrov and Patan, both playing the wing. Both natural centers. Mm-hmm. And if they're not natural centers, you see probably left wingers more than right wingers, and only one of them can play the left wing. It's like Stafford and Thorburn, only one of them can play the right wing. And you heard Stafford say he played last year in the left wing with Scheifele and Wheeler, but for the most part, he felt more comfortable being back on the right wing. So you have guys out of, like, even yesterday's lines at the end of the game, and I realized they were kind of out of it, but a bunch of pairings, a bunch of lines that just didn't seem to make sense to me. Guys playing in positions that they're not very familiar with, and usually that's going to result in mistakes.
Well, it explains what you saw last night then.
But that was already after that. That's what you're worried about.
Yeah. Let's head to break. When we come back, we'll bring in Sports Illustrated senior hockey writer Michael Farber. You also see him on TSN's The Reporters. You're listening to NHL This Week. We're live on TSN 1290. You're listening to NHL This Week. We're live on TSN 1290. This segment brought to you by Bernstein's Deli, the official deli of Illegal Curve Hockey. Conveniently located at Cordon and Lanark in the Cordon Village Mall, Bernstein's is a family-owned and operated traditional-style deli. Take it home or eat in their full-service restaurant. Bernstein's Deli has been Winnipeg's deli destination for nearly 30 years. For more information, find them on Facebook or at bernsteinsdeli.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
We are pleased to welcome back to the program Michael Farber. Michael is the senior writer for Sports Illustrated. He's also a panelist on TSN's The Reporters, which you can now see on Monday afternoons. Michael, good evening and welcome to the program. Thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you, gentlemen.
Michael, the last time we had you on, it was right after your trip to Israel, where you did a segment on the Israeli hockey program. And this book that we're having you on to discuss is called Sports Illustrated Hockey's Greatest. You didn't rank Israel's greatest hockey export, though.
we did not.
Yeah, didn't quite get that deep. But I must say, Michael, it is a fantastic book. Beautiful book, even more so. It's a great coffee table book. The photography in it is tremendous. What was the impetus for the for the book being created? Was it just, maybe try and solve those barroom discussions that we've been having for the last, three, four, five decades?
Either that or start some new ones. SI had done this for other sports and got around to hockey, and they asked me if I'd like to write the introduction, and I did, and There's a lot of the illustrated part of Sports Illustrated, but there's some stories in there as well, actually excerpts of stories that had run in the magazine. I've got a couple. E.M. Swift, tremendous writer, some of his other people as well. There were seven of us who ended up choosing our favorites in this listing, and I believe it was Winston Churchill who said that democracy is the worst form of government except for all the other forms. Well, choosing a book of lists, it's democracy, and it's a terrible form of choosing because my choice for goalie, the best goalie, ended up number five.
You know, Michael, I've had a chance to peruse the book and found it interesting. We've been talking a lot about Alex Ovechkin this year, and Gary Lawless had an article about Ovechkin. We were having an argument about whether Ovechkin's going to reach 700 goals. He's easily going to reach 500 goals. You've got him ranked fourth amongst left wingers, and you've got him 10th among the most exciting players of all time. Do you think it's safe to say that within the next 3 or 4 years, he's going to be climbing both of those rankings for left wingers and most entertaining players?
Yeah, I certainly think the left wing category. I believe Bobby Hull is number one, and he may not get to Bobby Hull, but before he's done, and he's been incredibly healthy for a player, and you always compare and contrast Crosby and Ovechkin because they came into the league at the same time, two generational talents. It's clear that if he continues to be healthy and Crosby doesn't, it'll be that Ovechkin is the guy who puts up the most points. And 700 goals, certainly possible. In fact, probable. And yeah, I can see Ovechkin finishing certainly in the top two all-time among the left wingers. The other thing is even more subjective. You know, what constitutes thrilling? I mean, for me, Gilbert Perreault was as exciting a hockey player as I ever saw. That might bring some people back, and some younger listeners may not even be fully aware of Gilbert Perreault. But he was such a spectacular skater. He would skate off people as he'd cross the blue line, create separation 10 feet sometimes. He was that good a skater. He's on the list. It depends on how you view things. But the way Ovechkin plays the game, there's certainly a thrill factor.
Michael, of all the positions and all the categories, which was the most difficult to rank?
Well, goaltending, I believe, because when you look at most lists, the greatest goalies were Sawchuk and Plante, maybe not in that order. And men who played for much, obviously not all of their career, without a mask, I mean, it's remarkable. But the game has changed so much, and I made an oblique reference to the guy I had number one on my list, and I saw Plante and Sawchuk only at the very end of their careers. But a guy I saw a lot of was Dominik Hasek, and he played goal at the highest level that I ever saw. And I live in Montreal, and I saw Patrick Waugh, obviously, a lot. And Patrick Waugh was the number one goalie, and Ken Dryden was great as well. But to me, when he was at the pinnacle, there was nobody who ever played the position better, at least as long as I've been watching hockey. And Hasek ended up fifth on the list.
Well, you know, it's interesting, Michael. I look through the coaches, and I find it interesting, you know, you go through Scotty Bowman being the number one, and I think that's probably one that you won't get too much argument on, and you have a lot of coaches in there who maybe our younger listeners, as you mentioned, may not know of. What about going forward? A lot of the coaches that you have there, you know, Fred Shiro, for example, they were very innovative. Do you think the next generation of coaches will have the ability to be as innovative with all the, you know, all the video now and all the leaning on the players to defend at all times, maybe at the expense of offense?
That's a fascinating concept. I really haven't thought about it. Curiously, Scotty Bowman wouldn't rank himself first. He would say that's Toe Blake. To me, it's because of what Bowman has done in different generations and his ability to innovate and adapt. I would put him with any coach in any sport, Vince Lombardi included. The fact that Bowman was so malleable, and even though he's perceived as somebody who was a dictatorial coach. To me, his ability to put together a Russian five, to coach in different generations and in different cities. Again, he had good teams to coach, and that's maybe a substantial part of his genius. But he was an innovator. But guys like Fred Shiro, who borrowed from the Russians early on, absolutely, he was an innovative coach. I wonder how we will view coaches like Mike Babcock down the road, because he has been dependent clearly on a lot of what Bowman did, or Joel Quenneville. I don't know if we will have the same kind of innovation. We've seen coaches try things. Guy Boucher, for example, who's coaching right now in Bern in Switzerland, some of the things that he came up with were pretty far out of the box. I believe that with the human spirit, what it is, coaches will look for different things. I wonder how far they can take the game, because for a lot of people right now, hockey is overcoached.
Yeah. You're listening to NHL This Week. We are joined by Sports Illustrated senior hockey writer Michael Farber discussing the new book, Sports Illustrated Hockey's Greatest, which ranks a number of different categories and related to the game we all know and love. Michael, wanted to ask you about the left wingers in the book. Now, you certainly won't get it. You're on a Winnipeg radio show, yeah, so you won't get any argument about Bobby Hull of the Golden Jet being number one overall. But after that, I mean, Luke Robitaille, number two, another guy we're familiar with here in Winnipeg, Keith Tkachuk coming in at is the 10th best left winger of all time. Is it safe to say that there's, you know, the rankings of the left wingers were a little bit, you know, less talented, let's say, than those of the centermen, the right wingers, and the defensemen and the goaltenders?
Well, even though Robitaille had the greatest number of goals for a left winger, I still didn't have him that high on my list. Sure. I think there was great disagreement there. You threw in Tkachuk. He was not on my list either. There were a bunch of players right around the Tkachuk level, including John LeClair and Kevin Stevens, and players who, you know, I kind of view in terms of their ability somewhere pretty similar. Yeah, it's, again, I didn't see other people's lists. I just had my own feelings. And, yeah, I think left wing is curious because Hull dominated it with what he did, and there were fewer great left wingers than they were centermen. And, again, we didn't do right and left defense. We just did defense. So, yeah, I think the wingers were a little bit problematic.
Michael, you just mentioned defense, and I got to ask you about two guys particularly, because they were just inducted into the Hockey Hall of Fame, Nicklas Lidström, Chris Pronger, not to mention Phil Housley. But with Nicklas Lidström coming in at two on your list, and I agree, you can't pass Bobby Orr at number four, but Chris Pronger at number 13 on your list, could you make the argument, and I guess you probably wouldn't be making this argument because you ranked them 11 places different, but could you make the argument that Chris Pronger was actually the more dominant defenseman of his era?
I wouldn't make that argument because Chris Pronger played a different style. In fact, it was almost outmoded, certainly towards the end of his career. Nick Lidström was the man of his time, like few we haven't seen. Orr was one of them. When the game was opening up, and here came Bobby Orr, and I saw him play in the original six as a rookie. His first year, I was 15 years old. I was living and going to high school in Providence, Rhode Island, and took a bus up to Boston and paid double face value from a scalper for a ticket in the End Arena in the Boston Garden. That was $5. It was a $2.50 ticket. And sat there with my mouth open, and that was Orr. Well, Lidström, in his own way, with stick positioning and body positioning and making the right play all the time, he was extraordinary. I don't know if you guys remember the 06 Olympics when Sweden went into the tank against Slovakia because it wanted to avoid Canada in the knockout round, and it ended up losing 5-2 or 5-3, I can't remember the score, to the Slovaks. At one point, there was a 5-on-3, full 2 minutes for Sweden, full 2 minutes. And here's the Swedish power play. Forsberg, Sundin, Modin, Freddie Modin had a great shot, Daniel Alfredsson, and Nick Lidström.
Wow.
And that's pretty good power play. 5-on-3. And they did not get a shot on goal. The closest they came was Lidstrom hit a post. And to this day, I believe that Nick Lidstrom was so good, he hit the post on purpose. And he was just a spectacular player. Oddly, I didn't have him number two on my list. To me, it was Doug Harvey. Again, that might be difficult for younger listeners to understand, but Tom Johnson, who was Bobby Orr's coach in Boston for a spell, and he was Doug Harvey's partner. In 07, during the Ottawa-Anaheim final, I was talking to Tom, and I said, so tell me, how much better was Orr than Harvey? And he said, I didn't say that. I said, well, you're saying that Harvey is better than Orr? He said, I didn't say that either. But they were in the same conversation, and that has always stuck with me. And without Doug Harvey, there wouldn't have been a Bobby Orr. So Lidstrom, even with the seven Norrises, I think I had him third. And there are some guys who, Bork, who was spectacular, and Denny Potvin, who was a particular favorite of mine because he played defense the way I was brought up to think defensemen should play. He cleared the crease. He was tough. He had a great shot. He would hip check. He would do all the things that a defenseman did in his era. Well, Nicholas Lidstrom did all the things that defensemen had to do in his era, and he did it better than anybody else. And I voted, and it stopped a couple years ago, but I voted for the NHL awards, and I would always have Nick Lidstrom, the Lady Bing, instead of giving it to the cleanest forward with some skill. I thought Nick Lidstrom, who played against the top lines all the time and took very few penalties, to me that was more worthy of a Lady Bing. So that would have even made his resume more gaudy.
You look at the games, Michael, and this is one I'm sure you'd always get much debate on. If my dad were here, he'd say number one would be the 70 game 8 of 72, which you guys have number 2. And then the one that caught my eye was number 7 on the list was game 3 between Canada and the USSR. Did you expect that to be a little bit higher than 7th overall?
You know what? If you look at the 7 voters, I live in Canada. I am not sure Pierre Maguire has lived in Canada. I think it's tilted in some way to the U.S., and I think that's natural because we filter everything through the membrane of our own experience. I think when you're looking at all-time rivalries, correct me if I'm wrong, but Canada-Russia came in number 9, which I think was way too low. So that you have to take that into account. So I understand that. But, yeah, I mean, if you go back to those 3 games, my goodness, I mean, that was, you know, that might have been hockey at its highest level. You can make that argument. And some of the hockey we saw in the 96 World Cup,
yes,
where the U.S. ended up beating Canada in Montreal, that was sublime hockey. And when Americans talk about the great hockey played by the States and the Miracle on Ice, to me it doesn't come close in terms of the quality of the hockey to what the golden generation or the greatest generation of U.S. players did in the 96 World Cup. I mentioned that to Brendan Shanahan a couple of months ago. He says, yeah, Tony Amonte, it was still a high stick.
A high stick. kicked in. It was also kicked in, right?
Well, you know, he's not letting that go. So, no, we've been very lucky, and that's why, as trumped up as it is, the World Cup, and I prefer to see nation upon nation to get really excited, and I think it's just a little bit out of my comfort zone, the 2016 World Cup. But we will see great hockey in September. And so how good is that? If you love the game, it doesn't matter that which country is playing it necessarily. It'll just be great hockey, and I think the game benefits.
The book is called Sports Illustrated, Hockey's Greatest. It's a fantastic read. It's a great coffee table book. Michael Farber, senior hockey writer for Sports Illustrated. You also see him on TSN's The Reporters. Michael, appreciate your time this evening. Thanks very much for joining us.
Gentlemen, my pleasure.
Take care, Michael.
Thanks a lot, Michael.
Let's head to break. You're listening to NHL This Week. We're live on TSN 1290.
Similar type of game, I think, with Minnesota, except they might have a little bit more firepower up front, where it's their quick transition. You know, if we're playing slow through the neutral zone, if we're not taking care of the puck, you know, they're a quick offense team. They'll quick strike right back at you. So we got to make sure that we're playing with enough pace and make sure we're taking care of the puck that, you know, we can take away their speed.
That's Drew Stafford discussing tomorrow evening's opponent, the Dallas Stars, as the Jets practiced earlier today in Dallas. That game tomorrow evening, I believe, a 7:30 puck drop here on TSN 1290. Richard, you're doing pre and post with Mr. Ralph, so you can hear your dulcet tones again tomorrow before Saturday's Illegal Curve show, 12 noon, as we'll get you set for the Jets and the Predators. Willie Donick, Nashville Predators play-by-play voice, is going to join us. This segment of the show brought to you by Frank Zappia and Mauro Zappia of Zappia Group Realty, official realtor of Illegal Curve Hockey. When 95% of your clients come via referral, it shows your commitment to honesty, integrity, and a total dedication to client satisfaction. For all your real estate needs, come shake hands with Frank and Mauro Zappia online at zappiagroup.com or at 204-772-2100. The Jets continue to take too many penalties. They've been shorthanded for 33 minutes and 4 seconds more than... they've spent more than they've spent on the power play, the most in the NHL. They've been shorthanded 63 times this season, the most in the league. It didn't cost them last night, but when you're playing tomorrow night against the number two power play in the NHL, which the Dallas Stars possess, taking penalties as the Jets have been doing so is really just a recipe for disaster.
Well, not only this, I mean, Drew, you're right. They're second in the league, but they're scoring at basically a 29% clip.
Yeah.
So you give them three power plays, they're going to score on one.
Mm-hmm.
And you just, I mean, Paul Maurice can deny that there's a penalty problem, and he wants them to be an aggressive team, and he probably will take some penalties with that. And they've killed penalties fairly well so far, Drew, being the ninth best penalty killing team in the league percentage-wise. But let's be honest here. And as he put together some of the minor penalties they've been taking, I mean, this is a problem. This is a problem. I mean, you can't take any stick penalties. And, I mean, they're not... I mean, everybody talks about them being that physical. I mean, they have some physical guys, but I don't think collectively they're that physical of a team.
It's actually... Sorry for interrupting, but, you know, when you... You see it way more on the national broadcast where they don't watch the Jets as often, and they just think that it's the same team from last year, which was physical, and they're talking about how physical and how big and how tough the Jets are on the a lot of times on the national broadcast.
Yeah, and they're not a soft team by any means, and they're physical, but I mean they're not this imposing team that everybody's worried about aside from Bufflin and Stewart, are their two big physical guys. And Trouba seems less this year than
But they're
past.
Not roller derby like they were last year for
no,
a lot
they're
of times.
Not. I mean really when they made the trade Kane and Bogosian, they became less physical.
Yeah.
Now they became smarter and more skilled. But
Jets have taken the most minor penalties with 71. Dustin Bufflin leads all players in the NHL with 12 minor penalties.
By the
penalties.
Way, I mean, Trouba took a couple of stupid penalties yesterday, but what's Bufflin thinking at the blue line there? I mean, these are just dumb. I mean, Shane says it on the television broadcast. I mean, you can't put up an argument for some of these penalties.
Yeah. You're right. I mean, it just continues to... I mean, I know I sort of downplayed it a couple weeks ago. I went through that.
You did.
And I admitted I downplayed it because I didn't think... I thought over the course of the year, it eventually sort of balances itself out and it's not that big a deal. But we're at the point now where this is, you know, a year plus.
Yeah.
And sure, some of these penalties are on reputation, but the reason why you're getting them on reputation is because that's your...
Are they on reputation?
I think some of them are.
Maybe as a team, not personally player by player.
Yeah, as a team they are, I think.
Maybe Bufflin a bit.
Yeah, but I mean, you know what? That's the reputation the Jets have made for themselves, and have to work doubly hard to change your reputation. So I don't fault the officials for making some weaker calls against the Jets, because they expect that every time the Jets are doing something physical, there's probably a penalty attached to it.
You know, Richie mentions Jacob Trouba, who took the hooking penalty on Charlie Coyle, and Wild didn't score, but then they scored right after he got out of the box. But for me, the issue is when you're down 5-1 in a game last night, and Bermy takes the tripping penalty towards the end of the second period. Bufflin, as Rich mentioned, takes the tripping penalty, and then they start off on the power play early in the third period. You can't get back in the game because killing penalties. Even though the Jets have scored quite a few shorthanded goals last year, Blake Wheeler, I think, had 3 or 4. But the point being, that's when it really hurts your momentum.
Trouba after the 5-3 goal, sorry.
Exactly. And you saw that many times last year, the Jets took the most minor penalties, or the second most minor penalties. This year, they've taken the most minor penalties. And Buff, for the last 3 years, has been top 10. So he took the second most minor penalties last year, and 2 years ago, he took the seventh most minor penalties. And again, we're not completely picking on Buff, because last year, Andrew Ladd, Mark Stewart, they had some issues. They've taken less penalties this year. But the point is, as a group, so whether it's Burmistrov, Trouba, Perreault, or Dustin Byfuglien, who leads the way, they're taking too many penalties, guys. And especially when you're struggling. It's one thing if you're winning five games in a row and you're on a nice winning streak. Sure, you're taking penalties, but the problem is your goaltending and defense masking some of those issues, right? And so, again, it's not something that's easy to solve. How do you take less penalties? Well, I mean, when you're the Jets and you play that aggressive type of game, you're going to take some penalties, especially with aggressive players like Buff. Trouba's aggressive, but the point is, your penalty kill has bailed you out. Yesterday, the Wild had six chances. They didn't score once. So
but on Saturday,
it wasn't a big issue.
But on Saturday, the Flyers scored two of their three goals on, on the power play.
And against a team like Dallas, who has the best power play in the league and had a very good power play last year, by the way. Sorry, second best, Richie. And they had a really good power play last year. I mean, this Dallas team is the best offense in the NHL, in my opinion. Well, I don't care about the numbers.
Let's read the five guys on the first power play unit. Ben, Sagan, Sharp, Spets, Klingberg.
Stay out of the box, Jets, because if you take three or four penalties, there's most likely going to be at least one goal coming back the other way. So this is an issue, again, and I think it's somewhat of a byproduct of the aggressive style they play, but I also think it's a discipline. They got to be more disciplined.
Yeah, I mean, it starts, you know, they can complain all they want, and I think it was after the Saturday game that Paul Maurice sort of complained about the officiating, or was it the Thursday game against Ottawa? I can't remember. It was in the last week he sort of made a comment about the officiating, and certainly there's some ticky-tack calls, but guess what?
There are some, for sure.
You know,
the hooking in front of the net was a bad call.
On Saturday, I thought the Blake Wheeler boarding penalty was a bad call. Yeah. You're always going to have some bad calls, throughout the course of a season and in a game, but the Jets can't blame everything on officiating.
It's on the Jets to clean up their reputation before they're going to get the benefit of the doubt.
Tomorrow's a great start. As we just mentioned, their top the power play unit, you'd be hard-pressed to argue there's a better five-man offensive unit in the NHL in the power play than the five-man unit we just read.
I don't even think it's an argument.
Sagan, Sharp, Spezza, and Klingberg. So if you can't cut down on it going into tomorrow night's game,
You're going to be in trouble. Let's head to break. When we come back, Craig Ludwig, Dallas Stars analyst, is going to join us. You're listening to NHL This Week. We're live on TSN 1290. Second hour of NHL This Week. Drew Mandel alongside Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg. This segment brought to you by Keener Jerseys. Keener Jerseys has become known as the world's best jersey customizer. Keener's knowledge of jerseys is unsurpassed. If you want awesome jerseys for your team or have a jersey you want customized, visit Keener Jerseys online at keenerjerseys.com or find them on your next opponent.
Now, let's go live on the Legal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
Our next guest is a Dallas Stars analyst on Fox Sports Southwest. He, of course, played for the Stars, and prior to that, the Montreal Canadiens. We're pleased to welcome to the program Craig Ludwig. Craig, good evening, and thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Our pleasure. Craig obviously brought you on to talk about the Stars ahead of tomorrow night's Jets-Stars game in Dallas. A tremendous start to the year for the team from Dallas. 12-4 to start. I guess you're happy that you're done with the Leafs now, as if you'd said that two of your four losses come to the Toronto Maple Leafs, you'd be surprised at that point.
Hey, who'd have thunk that a week or two ago? You know, it's tough. But again, I think you have to, you know, aim it directly at Reimer. Reimer was great in both games. And, you know, I look at a guy like that, you know, they had, Bernier goes on the IR, and I think that he saw an opportunity to take the ball and gives him an opportunity to show that he wants to be number one, and he's taken advantage of it. Dallas had their opportunities, though, and like Dallas will have their opportunities against every game, I'm sure, as a lot of teams out there know, and they're a very powerful and strong team offensively, and they can create a lot of things. And I think Lindy Ruff has done a great job with these guys and allows them to play to their strengths. And there's a lot of confidence that has grown from last year to this year. And last year, you know, for the Stars, it was one of those kind of years where they were finding ways to lose hockey games, especially in third periods. And they've, for the most part, they flipped that around this year, and they found ways to win hockey games. And it's kind of a double-edged sword. You know, you've got the confidence knowing that you're, if you're down a goal or even two goals, that you have the ability to come back. But it's probably not a recipe for success over the long haul. And there are not a lot of teams want to go into the third period trailing, because we know what the numbers are and the percentage of winning those hockey games. But so far this year, Dallas has been pretty good at them. And, you know, they're going to try to get back on track tomorrow night against a pretty big physical club.
Craig wanted to talk, of course. I mean, last year, you know, it was a disappointing year, but the offensive weapons were there for the Stars last year. The goaltending wasn't. And then, you know, with this offseason, Jim Nill goes out and he acquires Antti Niemi, and he says, you know, it's going to be an open competition, but you got Niemi and you got Kari Lehtinen. And so far, they've both had very solid years to start. Lehtinen, you know, slightly better numbers and slightly fewer games than Niemi. But has this sort of battle for the goaltending position really done, you know, a world of difference in improving the Stars' fortunes overall?
Well, I think it has, and I think the reason it has is because not just the two goaltenders, but I believe that as a group, that it's about the group this year, and it's about the common goal, and it's about getting, you know, to the playoffs. So however we've got to do it, they're all going to pull on that rope the same way. You know, they've got a saying in the locker room that they put up. Man, I think it's like a year ago now, where it's just it's very simple. Everybody ropes, everybody rides. And you know, this year, everybody's pulling on that rope the same way. And I think with the two goalies, and obviously they're both Finnish, they're friends and played together when they were 10 or 12 years old. But you know, it's a healthy competition, and they pretty much know if, you know, I'm going to get the ball and I'm going to run, and as long as I play well, I can probably get a start. And, you know, I think in Kari's circumstance, over the last few years, when if Kari got yanked in a game or didn't have a good game or maybe not a good stretch of two or three games, he was probably pretty comfortable that he was going to start the next game regardless, because the backup situation wasn't great here, and he didn't have anybody to push him. And now I think with both of these guys basically being a 1A and a 1B, you know, they're not that they're fighting for ice time. I just think that they understand that there's two of us here that can do the job. And over the long haul, it could pay off at the right time of the year, where we're not going to play 70 games apiece, obviously. And if we play 40 or 45, and the other guy plays 30 or 35, whatever that may be, you know, we're going to be better off for it when we get to the playoffs, and hopefully we're a little bit more rested up than we have been. Kyrie's logged a lot of minutes since he's been here, and with the exception of last year, in my mind, without question, he's been the MVP. And, you know, every year there's been, you know, work in progress, I guess is what we call it. I refuse to call it that anymore, because you can only work on that kind of stuff year after year for so long. And that's been in our D zone. And he's cleaned up a lot of mistakes. And in all honesty, this year, that there still has been some of those mistakes that are being made. But both of these guys have come in and they've stole games that they probably didn't deserve to win. And I think there's other times where the Stars have come out and, you know, if you know, less than good goal has gone in against one of these guys, they've bailed their goaltenders out by getting them some run support. You know, they're not scoring two goals or three goals, and they're in the 3-4 range every night. So it takes a little bit of pressure off those goaltenders, knowing that more than likely I'm going to get her two or three goals here tonight, and I got to close the door with two or so against.
Craig, speaking of goals, you won the Stanley Cup in 1999 with Dallas. Should mention, too, you won the Stanley Cup in 1986 with the Habs. You played with two of the greatest goal scorers of all time in Brett Hull and Mike Modano. Do you see similarities between Modano and Hull and Sagan and Benn, who are 1-2 in scoring in the NHL right now?
Well, I don't know if anybody's ever going to compare to Hully. I mean, there's only one Brett Hull, I can tell you that much. You know, we were lucky to have him. But I just think that Tyler, the game is different. We know that, and I don't think Hully's going to tell you that he was anywhere near in the same skating class as either Jamie or Tyler. Mm-hmm. You know, Brett was a scorer, and he was a pure natural goal scorer, and Mike had the ability to find him. And I think when you look at Jamie and Tyler, and, you know, I think we refer to them around here as Batman and Robin, and they kind of switch capes once in a while. We don't know who's who, and we don't really care who's who. They play off each other. And, you know, I think there's a real good competition there, too, for You know, Jamie won the Hart last year, and Tyler would love to have it. And But again, I don't think that that's what the goal is for either one of these guys. They know that they need to go deep, and they're still young, and they're in the prime of their careers, and Tyler's not even in the prime of his career. But, you know, and then you take a guy like Patrick Sharp and throw him in that line, or Jason Spezza, or whoever Lindy wants to throw in that role, it's pretty easy to adapt to these guys. You know, we've got those kind of players here, but, you know, they're different players, I think, from Mike and Brett. And again, it's such a fast game today. And you know, when you talk about Tyler Seguin, he has the ability to do things going, you know, full speed. And that's kind of like what Mike was. And Mo was the kind of guy that could do things at top end. And Jamie, I look at Jamie Benn as the kind of guy that when he's on his game and when things are, when he sets the tone for games, it starts with a physical presence, and Jamie doesn't have to dangle to be effective. He's a guy, you know, that I think when he's going through you versus around you, he sets the tone for the club, and they follow that, and Jamie knows that. And so Jamie Benn can play whatever game you want to throw out there, but I think when he's most effective is when he starts in that physical mode, and when he wants to run over people, and he gets defensemen especially kind of looking in the rearview mirror seeing where he's going to come from. And that creates a little bit of space for him. And so, again, these guys play off each other. They have different strengths, and they complement each other really well.
Craig, why don't you get your take on, you know, John Klingberg's obviously been very impressive to start the season. But, you know, I said last year on the show, he reminded me a lot of your former teammate, Sergei Zubov. Do you see some similarities, you know, right-handed guy, kind of sees the game really well, patient. Maybe he's a little bit bigger and seems to be a little bit more aggressive at times, but is there some similarities there, and what do you like most about his game?
Well, I think what they both had is they had the ability to slow the game down, and there's no panic, and there was no panic. And I had the privilege to play with Zuby, and a lot of times I got caught watching what he was doing, and if he ever did turn the puck over, it kind of caught me off guard because he never did, and it was a scramble to get back into – in a position. But you know, there's just no panic, especially when they're under pressure. And where it really stands out with Klingberg is in his own end, deep in his end, in the corner, with a guy coming at him or two guys coming at him, and then at the offensive blue line, where I think a lot of people would be in that panic where they'd want to get rid of the puck, and whether they move it up the wall or if they're on the offensive blue line, make sure they don't turn it over. There's ice in his veins, and Zuby was the kind of guy, you know, and John is still young, so there's still some mistakes that are being made, and that's going to happen, and especially in the D zone. And I think there's times that maybe you'd like to see him, whether it's go off the wall or make a little bit more high percentage play, but again, I think you've got to be careful there because he can do so many things, and this team exits the zone so much more efficiently when he's got the puck on his stick and makes passes that a lot of people wouldn't dare to make. And I think sometimes it catches the opponent off guard thinking that there's no way he's going to go through the middle of the ice right here. He's not going to throw it in front of his net, or he's not going to make a 50-foot backhand pass across the front of his net. So, and he's got the confidence to do it. And I think the biggest part of that is the coaching staff sees that, management sees that and says, you know what, we got to let this guy be who he is. And I think that's where Zuby was the same way. Personally for me, I've never really played with anybody that had the kind of ability and vision to do the things that Zuby could do. And John Klingberg is probably the closest guy to Sergei Zubov that's been around here that I've seen in a long time.
Craig Ludwig is our guest on NHL This Week. Craig is a Dallas Stars analyst for Fox Sports Southwest. I wanted to stick on the back end and ask you about Johnny Oduya. He comes over from Chicago in the offseason. You know, how has he fit in with the Dallas Stars? And has he sort of provided sort of a stabilizing force as a veteran presence on what had been a young back end relatively that sort of had struggled last season?
He's been a silent teacher. And I think that the guys watch the way he plays the game. First off, when a guy like that comes over, along with Sharp and even Niemi, but when those two guys come over here and they've got the pedigree that they have and they've had the ability to win some championships, and especially when he was teamed up with Jalmerson in Chicago, they were that shutdown guy. And there's probably not a guy that puts more pucks off the wall or off the glass than Oduya, but it's the right play. he's a quiet player. He just does the right things, and I think he calms things down, and he doesn't go running around his own end. He's very secure in who he is, and he knows what his role is. And we've got other guys here. I mean, we've got guys that aren't in the lineup, and Nemeth and Oleksiak, and whether it's Yoki Pak or who's ever in there, that can learn things from him because, you know, we've got Klingberg, we've got Goligoski, we've got Jason Demers, who likes to get up on the play and can skate and, you know, move the puck and jump into the offense, and that's great. And then there's got to be the guys that complement those guys and the guys that can calm things down and play well in front of their own net and be a little bit more aggressive and use their size and strength and the position. And you know, and I think that's what John Oduya does, is he uses his position correctly all the time. It's not like he's, you know, he's perfect, and but he's going to make mistakes also. But they're hardworking mistakes, and they're mistakes that you're trying to do the right thing. But for the most part, he's just a sound defenseman that makes the right play at the right time.
Craig, I remember a couple of years ago when the Dallas Stars were in Winnipeg, and I think the score was 5-2. They dominated the Jets, and Valeri Nichushkin was one of the best players, and I know that he missed most of last season with an injury. He's off to a really slow start this year, one goal in 14 games. Is it just a slow start for Valeri, or is there something else there?
Nope. He has been night and day in the last 2 weeks, and I think it was a slow start the first five or six games. And I think for Val, it's about mainly using his size, getting involved. He's got the strength and the ability to drive wide. I love it when he plays on his offside. Mm-hmm. I think in today's game, with the way that the rules are called, and, you know, if a guy with that kind of size and skating ability can get the edge on you and start to cut to the net, you really only have a couple choices, and one is probably to grab him, which draws a penalty, and the other one's to try to retreat and get back. And by then, you know, he should have the ability to cut in, and that's what he's done. He's done that over the last four or five games, and he's been noticeable over the last four or five games. And his ice time is reflecting of it. You know, Lindy's giving him more time, and I think Lindy's worked quite a bit with him, trying to get him to buy into that part of the game. And I think that, you know, for a while, for me, I think players have to earn their ice time, and I think he was slotted in the top six, and there were games when he probably didn't deserve to be there, and I think the people that he was playing with, he wasn't really helping them, and I think you know, he sat out a game and he comes back, and I think that he understands what he's got to do to get back into that top six, and he's been very effective in the last four or five games, and he's doing all those little things. He's driving to the net, he's stopping at the net. You know, he's understanding that when he's on his off wing, because eventually when a forward wants to start to get the edge and start to cut to the front of the net and you get around you and drive the net, the next time that happens, the defenseman will probably give you a little bit more space. And coming in on his offside now, he can pull up and get to his forehand and let that shot go. He's got a great shot. So he's doing a lot of good things. And again, I think that, you know, the light bulb came on, whether it was, you know, four games ago or it was just a little dim in the beginning, but again, you know, he came back from an injury. You know, he had a real good first season, and then he went through some injuries and basically missed the whole season. And I think he's up and running right now. And he was my key to the season when we started. Val needed to be a good player for this team to have the depth that they wanted to have, because the top six guys are there, and then when you know you've got Cody Eakin, you've got Anton Roussel and Vern Fiddler, and so, you know, Val slots in there, and I think that he's eventually going to get some time on the power play. And right now, I heard you guys talking about it. I mean, there's no question it's a star-studded power play out there, and it's tough to get some minutes on that right now, especially the way the guys are going now. But he will get his opportunity, and he'll probably be a guy that'll end up in front of the net on the power play, and he'll be tough to move.
Craig, final question for you. I know it's kind of, there have been so many guys who have performed well for this Dallas Stars team, but about a week from now, last year, Jim Neal made the trade, you know, kind of went under the radar a bit, acquiring Jason Demers from San Jose for Brendan Dillon, really kind of trading left side guy who played a skill, tough game and a really respected game in Dillon to a team in San Jose that seemed to need it, and acquiring a guy who can move the puck, and Demers seems to have played really well. And in the few games I've seen, has really moved the puck well. What has he added to the squad, and how is he different from last year?
Well, I think confidence, number one. I think he's comfortable with where he is and you know, the system and everything that we're playing here. But, you know, the when you mention his name, I think the first word that comes to my mind is compete. And that's what he does. Every shift he competes. And he doesn't, and again, not that we all make the right plays and a lot of us make the wrong plays, but again, he's another guy that if there is a mistake made by him, it's you can live with it because it was because of hard work. And but what he does is he competes every shift, and I think he's getting a little bit more. I think it's nice that he's playing with Odulia because he knows that Odulia is that kind of guy, and so he likes to jump in the play, and he's a great skater, and so he can follow it up a little bit closer now. And you know, I was surprised when Brendan Dillon was moved for Jason. I was shocked because you know, I really like Brendan Dillon, and I think he's a guy that's going to grow into be a real good physical type of defenseman that this team needs and that's been missing. But and I was kind of shocked when it happened, but now after watching Jason for, you know, since he got here, especially this year, he's been excellent. I think he's been doing and giving everything that the team has asked him to do, and he's getting involved offensively, and he's racking up some points, and he's got a couple goals already, and that's a bonus. But again, I think the way that he plays and with his partner, they're a good pairing, and sometimes I'm surprised that those guys not playing against top lines. It'll be interesting tomorrow night. You know, you guys got a big club, and you know, it's to steal a word from Brian Berg, I mean, it's a truculent club, and they're big, and they're another kind of a team, I think, that has the identity that would prefer to go over you or through you than go around you. And so it'll be interesting for me. This is one of the games I've been looking forward to. I want to see where the Dallas Stars are. From an all-around game, but more importantly in their own end, to be able to handle the size and strength that the Winnipeg Jets can throw at them. And so we'll see how Klingberg and Goligoski as a pair can handle that type of game, because I know that Paul Maurice would like to continue to play that game. And, like I said, they've got an identity. These guys know what their identity is. And sometimes that identity can hurt you a bit, especially against a team like the Dallas Stars, because of their ability to probably hurt you on the power play. And so we'll see how that all plays out tomorrow night.
Craig Ludwig is a Dallas Stars analyst for Fox Sports Southwest. Craig, really appreciate your time this evening. Thanks very much for joining us, and enjoy tomorrow evening's contest.
Well, thanks, guys. I appreciate you having me on.
Thanks, Craig. Take care. Let's head to break. You're listening to NHL This Week. We're live on TSN 1290. Big thanks to Craig Ludwig for joining us on the program to preview tomorrow night's Stars-Jets game. And of course, before him, Michael Farber of Sports Illustrated. In case you missed either of those interviews, they'll be available for download on iTunes, on tsn1290.ca, and of course on our website, illegalcurve.com. This segment brought to you by Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club, officially declared the funniest place in Winnipeg by Illegal Curve Hockey. For 30 years, Rumors has been bringing Winnipeg the best in stand-up comedy. To purchase tickets or for a list of performers and showtimes, visit rumorscomedyclub.com. This week at Rumors, local boy done very well, Matt Falk in town. The Saturday show, the early one, is already sold out, so you know tickets are moving quickly. Be sure to get your tickets for Matt Falk and any of the upcoming great comedians at rumorscomedyclub.com.
Yeah, I saw, Drew, recently it was announced that Donnell Rawlins is going to be playing Rumors.
That's right.
Very funny guy. Yeah. If you remember him, really funny stuff from the Chappelle Show.
That's
so
correct.
I saw that and I immediately got tickets to that.
Donnell Rawlins at Rumors from January 20th through the 23rd, a concert series event. So you know tickets are going to go very quickly. Check him out, rumorscomedyclub.com. Gentlemen, the general managers met yesterday in Toronto. Not a lot coming out of the meetings. It was sort of a quieter general managers meetings. The compensation issue, which they managed to screw up somehow. I mean, did these guys not do...
By the way, was that an intentional screw-up by Gary Bettman? And I don't actually think this is actually quite clever on his part.
No, I don't think they... I think they demanded it, and when they screwed it up, and I think he just said, well, you guys screwed it up. You guys deal with it.
I think he's... I've been critical of Gary Bettman before. I mean, there's going to be criticisms of a commissioner that makes a lot of decisions, and I've been critical of Gary Bettman before. I'm going to give him credit here. He's he's a very smart guy, and I think that he thought this was an ill-advised plan, and he was going to enforce it to the letter of the law to show how ridiculous it was.
Well, that's what I think the problem was, is that the general managers just didn't really drill it. Maybe they rushed it through, or they didn't drill down the details of it.
They were concerned about teams poaching their talent and mm-hmm. putting them in positions that were essentially the same with different titles.
Right.
So that's why they put this into place. And what? How it had to do, see, I'm assuming Gary Bettman, because he didn't support it, didn't want to partake in craft in the wording to make it.
Well, how the general managers managed to screw it up and not sort of exclude fired coaches from deserving of compensation. Was there none of the 30 general managers? There's some lawyers in that group that should know how to write a contract or know how to write a law that, you know, really gets to the heart of what they're looking for, and they managed to screw it up pretty badly.
And that's the issue, right? That's the reason it's being brought up, because you better believe Jarmo Kekäläinen is not happy, or pardon me, not Jarmo Kekäläinen, Jim Benning and the Vancouver Canucks are not happy that they're going to have to give up the pick in the next 3 years. You're right.
Jarmo Kekäläinen. You had it right.
Jarmo Kekäläinen.
Giving the pick to Benning.
Oh, sorry. Yes. Right. Sorry, I'm getting confused here. Jarmo Kekäläinen will have to give up the Columbus Blue Jackets have to give up the second round pick in the next 3 years.
For hiring a guy who was fired, who they're doing the Canucks a favor by getting him off their books. Yes. I mean,
Jim Benning is happy.
Jim Benning is, I mean, from my perspective, that should have been immediately why they didn't hire John Tortorella.
Right. Well, actually, I can think of other reasons, too.
What happens if that second round pick, and we know that second round
picks can be
just as successful as first round picks. So if that second round pick turns out to be a 40 goal scorer a few years down the road, it's going to be an unfortunate situation for the Columbus Blue Jackets. But you're right. This is something that really should have never been enacted in the first place, Drew.
Absolutely. The larger nets. Mike Babcock is banging the drum for larger nets.
I don't like this.
Brian Burke is against it.
Yes.
Brian Burke on this one.
That makes it unanimous around this
table. I'm usually with Brian Burke. I feel like he's the voice of reason for me.
That's because he beat you up in a barn once.
No, I mean, Brian Burke and me saw eye to eye. I don't know Brian Burke personally. Maybe we can get him on the show. But I didn't agree with all the advanced stats wave. I like advanced stats, but Brian Burke, I think, was kind of, you know, tempered everyone's expectations of what advanced stats were going to do in the NHL. But as far as large nets go, and I know Darren Dreger was on HNL earlier today talking about this, you're going to run into issues, Rich, with larger nets, because if you bring in larger nets in the NHL, are you going to bring in larger nets in the CHL? In the MJHL? I mean, I think the issue is
You're not looking at the core of the problem.
Right. And the core of the problem, goaltending equipment is one thing.
If you think there is a problem.
Right.
I mean, you got to agree that there is a problem that, you know, the goal scoring, that there's too few goals being scored.
Goal scoring is definitely down in the NHL.
But
there's no doubt about that.
Sure, but why? I mean, it's been pretty consistently like this for a while. Why suddenly is the net because a prolific coach has mentioned it?
I don't know.
There are other ways?
Because somebody in Toronto said something, so we all have to go crazy?
Like, ideas that I mean, I'm not saying I have all the ideas in the world here, but I would regulate shot blocking before I'd make the nets bigger.
Yeah.
Would you look at the goaltending equipment again?
Yes, absolutely.
How do you regulate shot blocking, though?
You don't allow it.
So I tee up a slap shot, and I have to get out of the way of it as a defender?
More goals, weren't there?
There certainly would be more goals, but I mean, I don't know.
Does shot blocking bring anything to the game?
No, but it is a skill, I find. I think it's taking
I'm not saying it's not, but does it bring anything to the game? I mean,
well, shot blocking was always allowed in the 70s and the 80s.
You weren't wearing a helmet. You weren't blocking a lot of shots.
Well, you weren't wearing body armor is the difference. The equipment hurts.
That's right.
You didn't want to block a shot because your shin pads weren't made out of Kevlar or something.
Yeah, it was the old Don Cherry knocking the elbow pad against the table. I mean, you hear the sound.
But, I mean, you know, I don't think you're going to legislate shot blocking out of the game, but I think you can really do something about the goaltending equipment.
Well, sure you can, but we've talked about this since Gar Snow in 1997, for God's sake.
I know, it's been ridiculous.
Well, Kay Whitmore and the NHL are always looking at goaltending equipment, right?
They're not looking
hard. I mean, we have pads. The goaltender goes down, and the pads, the inside pad that quote-unquote protects him, pops out as a flap.
Yeah.
You're trying to score in a score five hole.
See, to me, Drew, and I remember last year we had an entire segment on how to open up the game and increase scoring. I believe we talked about the trapezoid. We talked about possibly not calling icing when a team is not being able to ice the puck. Pardon me, calling icing on a penalty kill to increase scoring. Other ways, increasing the net, I mean, to me, that's no different than making basketballs bigger or making the baseball bigger. I mean, you can't make. I realize what the issue is here.
It's akin to making the net bigger in basketball and a baseball bigger. Right. That's a good point.
Goaltenders average 6 foot four.
Deflating the ball
now.
For Tom Brady.
I mean, the era of Darren Pang and Mike Vernon just doesn't exist anymore. You don't have 5 foot five, 5 foot eight goaltenders anymore. They're bigger. I get that.
Yeah.
But to me, when coaches strategize to decrease scoring, whether John Tortorella years ago in New York with blocking shots or whatever, and he continued that in Vancouver, by the way, but. If you know, you talk about taking out shot blocking, I think you got to leave that in. Maybe you look at ways to decrease it. It's a tough one. But the issue here is, are you going to upset the integrity of the game, right? Is that going to change it too much dramatically in the wrong way? I think it would. And then you get into, well, how much are you going to make the nets bigger? Is it going to be just a couple inches? Well, if you're just making the nets a couple inches bigger, whether you're talking about the height or the width, is that really going to increase goal scoring that much? I think it would be pretty marginal if you're just going to make the nets a little bit bigger. So to me, I really, Mike Babcock, I understand he has a point here. But I don't know if this is going anywhere.
Unless you're going, you want to increase goal scoring, you get rid of four NHL teams. It's not going to happen. And you shrink the goaltending equipment. Anything else is just window dressing and doesn't really solve the problem.
Well, I think
Mike Babcock is the coach, as he that in the 2014 Olympics. Again, they won, but he coached arguably the most talented team of all time to play the most defensive style.
A lot of 1-0, 2-1 games.
Oh, they just said we'll never give up the puck.
So how about you shrink the net even more?
Well, he knew what he needed to do. Anyways, that's it for the general managers meetings. When we come back, we'll look at the future state of hockey journalism going forward here in the NHL in the 21st century. You're listening to NHL This Week. We're live on TSN 1290. Drew Mundell alongside Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg. You're listening to NHL This Week. A reminder, the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, 6 p.m. this coming Saturday. We'll get you set for the Jets and the Predators live in Nashville. That game will be the third game on the Jets' current four-game road trip as they look to make some ground up in the Central Division.
Love that Pearl Jam that Rory's playing out of the break. Great band.
Bob McKenzie, congratulations, of course, extended to him, received the prestigious Hockey Hall of Fame Elmer Ferguson Memorial Award for excellence in hockey journalism.
Well-deserved.
And certainly well-deserved. I'm surprised it's actually taken this long, given Bob McKenzie's history of being one of the preeminent hockey journalists that has covered this sport. In fact, if you haven't seen a very funny video on TSN.ca, I'm sure it was broadcast on TSN as well, where they show the real hockey insider isn't, in fact, Bob McKenzie, but it's his wife, Cindy McKenzie. It's a very clever video, so you can check that out. You know, I want to spend a few minutes discussing the future of this award. You know, we're in a very tumultuous state of times when it comes to media in general, especially print journalism.
It's scary.
And that, of course, is where Bob McKenzie, you know, first made his name as the editor of the Hockey News prior to becoming much more known for his work on TSN.
Yep.
You know, what's this award going to look like going forward? Is this an award that's not going to be based on, you know, journalism so much as it is based on, you know, breaking tweets and breaking news on Twitter and that sort of thing going forward?
Well, I hope that it's about journalism in its purest sense, whether that's writing or television reporting. I mean, I mentioned, you know, when you said that, Drew, that it's scary because you see so many cuts happening and the media world completely shrinking. You know, I took journalism at Red River, graduated 6 years ago. It's crazy that it was 6 years ago, but we were feeling it back then, right? So few jobs, I should say. But, you know, it's interesting because there's such a movement towards more online journalism, right? Newspapers are having difficulty selling newspapers in the traditional sense. We know that. So I think that, you know, moving forward, you're still going to see journalism in the sense, whether that's on TSN.ca or LegalCurve.com has some pretty good writing too. Well, when Richie writes, it's good.
Yeah.
Me, not so much.
No, it's really just chicken scratch.
But, you know, I hope that it's not moving towards that, Drew, because to me, Twitter is not really enough space to properly articulate a story, right? I mean, it's great for breaking news, and Bob McKenzie and Drager and all these guys do it better than anybody. But to me, journalism is still about stories, and that is either long form or short form. But to me, I'm a traditionalist, so I still love reading print and the written form, right? So if you're giving out awards and stuff like that 10 years from now based on tweets and social media, then to me that's going to be a shame.
Well, I mean, that exactly. As you look at the definition of the award, you're reading off of TSN.ca, the award goes annually to a member of the hockey writing profession whose words have brought, and this is quote, whose words have brought honor to journalism and hockey. I mean, we don't, there's no question Bob McKenzie is worthy of this award. So, I mean, let's just qualify everything by saying that. The question is, on a broader level, is if Bob McKenzie's career happened from now and for the next 30, 35 years, writing for, you know, Globe and Mail for a bit, Hockey News, Toronto Star, all that stuff, would he be honored with this award for the particular point of whose words have brought honor to journalism and hockey? Because, I mean, reality now, Bob is more on TV and he's reporting trades and doing all that stuff. So is this award going to become the guy who reports all the trades? Or is this report going to go to the guy, the reward going to go to the guy who's writing and giving you the long form, if, you know, even though that seems to be a dying breed?
And I think it's going to be a combination of the both, Rich. I think it's going to be more so the reporting, but I think there's going to be more and more of the tweeting and social media. I mean, I don't even think we've scratched the surface of social media. We're just really within the first 10 years of social media being a dominant form of communication, right? But I still think, and again, maybe this is the traditionalist in me, but to me, you need more than a few hundred characters to really tell a story, right? That's what we're talking about, storytelling, really getting in-depth into stories. Whether that's a feature piece, a human interest piece, or, you know, breaking down a game, I still think, you know, when I really want to know what happens in a game, I need to read the beat writer's story. If I'm looking at the Dallas-Toronto game, I got to read Mike Hajka. And, right. And to really understand what happened in the game, I got to read Kevin McGran and the Toronto Star, right? Like, I can't just read a couple
like
of
most.
Tweets.
I don't think you're like most. I'm with you. I agree with you. And
I might be old school.
And I probably am too. But for example, Darren Dreger, who hasn't written really, I mean, he was at, what, CKY here. He went to the other place. And then he's at TSN, although the other place is owned by different people at the time. Anyhow, the point is, he's never really been a writer. So would he ever qualify years from now to be the guy for Elmer Ferguson Award, for the guy whose words have brought honor to journalism and hockey? Well, I guess if it's a spoken word, maybe. But is the breaking news person now going to be that next step? I think it's interesting. I mean, what, this next generation of writing?
Well, you know, I think there still is a platform for good quality writing. It's just online. That's the platform.
Yeah.
That's where it's going to happen. I mean, NHL.com, I mean, which, you know...
Drew, you can't read a story now without it being broken up by bullet points.
Yes. And that's, I think, it has a function of, you know, people and their short attention spans more than anything else.
That's exactly right.
I mean, that's not a fault of the journalist. I think that's just catering to the audience, which, you know, may enjoy things in small, digestible amounts as opposed to anything, you know, big and complex. But, I mean, there is certainly an opportunity for fantastic long-form writing. It's just, are the resources behind it? I think a lot of these guys who cover the game, I think, would love to delve deep into the stories. The problem is nowadays, how much time do these guys ever spend with the players themselves to tell their stories? Very rarely. I mean, you're at the rink, they're on the plane.
Cliche comments and that say nothing about anything.
Right, because it's not in their interest, in the player's interest. They don't ever, you know, in the olden days when the players didn't travel charters necessarily and they spent more time in away cities when they'd be on the road at the same time with journalists, they could sit down one-on-one off the record, get to know one another, and tell, I mean, Al Strachan, you know, who Hall of Fame journalist, probably was, I'm pretty sure he's probably won this award in past as well, you know, has great stories. There aren't great stories that you hear anymore because I think that the dynamic has changed in how the players and the writers interact so that there's nobody, the players don't trust the writers to tell the story. The teams, you know, don't trust the writers to tell these stories. How often do you hear, I mean...
Yeah, Strachan won 93.
Okay, well, there you go. So, I mean, you know, you just... The opportunity for these guys to get to know each other on a personal level, to feel comfortable telling their stories and writing these great articles, just isn't there because of the nature of the business now with charters, and you leave right after the game ends. I mean, how many times have we been on the show where, you know, or we've had old guests who played for the, you know, played in Winnipeg during the Jets 1.0 when they would say, you know, they'd say to us, you know, is the pal still there? Because the players used
to... Well, for two more months.
Well, for but back in the day, remember, is the PAL still there? We'd get that question a lot.
We're going to go, right, Drew?
Yeah, because players spent time in Winnipeg after the game. Nowadays, they don't spend any time here, the road teams. They're on the plane immediately. Same thing. It doesn't allow them to spend any time to get their stories out, get their stories told.
And it's unfortunate. And again, I mean, maybe I'm from a different generation. If you ask someone...
Well, yeah, you're 20 years younger than Drew.
Well, exactly, Richie.
What does that make you?
But when you talk about this, I mean, I love... And I mean, I'm a journalism student, so yeah. and a fan of the game and a fan of the history of the game. So maybe I'm different, but I don't think I'm alone out there, whether that's someone who's older than me or younger than me. I still think there's an appetite for long-form journalism. And I agree with you, Drew. The trend has been to online for well over 10 years now. That's not something that is going to change. It's just going to get more and more online as far as how you absorb and eat your news, right?
You can write long-form, but is anybody going to pay you for it? And if nobody's going to pay you for it, are you going to do it? And if you're not going to get paid for it or do it, there's nothing to read. And if you're not getting paid for it, yeah. You're only going to do it for so long.
And those are fundamental problems with the availability and the business structure around media. I'm looking more at the relationships. The relationships just aren't there to allow for those stories to be told nearly as often as they used to be in the olden days.
It's going to be very the way this award looks is going to be very interesting because if you look again, I'm on the Hockey Hall of Fame website. It said whose words have brought honor to journalism and to hockey. So is that going to be broadened?
Well, let me ask you, on that list of people, you know, who've won it, and I'm not going to ask you to go through the
sure,
list
yeah,
right now.
Yeah.
What great writers are left? What great writer jumps out to you with a name that hasn't won that award at this point in time?
There's still a few guys recovering the game now who aren't on the list, Drew. Who will make their way on there. But I think it's the next level after that is what I'm wondering. Because, I mean, so many of these teams aren't sending guys or girls on the road.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned, you know, there's relationships and such. And if it's going to be cut down, is it going to be TV? But then, I mean, it's different. It's not. Is that journalism? Is it television journalism? It's a written word we're talking about here,
yeah.
In my opinion.
We'll see. It'll be one of those things that we can revisit and look back in 10 years, and we'll see who's winning that award at that point in time. Let's head to break. When we come back, we'll talk about some of the Hockey Hall of Fame inductees from Monday night. You're listening to NHL This Week. We're live on TSN 1290.
And Pronger has given the Ducks the lead at 5-4.
Fedorov is in there. Score! What a beauty! Fedorov all the way just about. And he made it look easy.
He sends it ahead to a rushing Housley. Housley's got a breakaway. Going right in and goes. Shoots. He scores!
Big thanks to producer Rory producing that intro. Big congratulations to all the Hockey Hall of Fame inductees from earlier this week. Lidstrom and Pronger, I would suggest, can't shortchange Fedorov, I guess. Lidstrom, Pronger, and Fedorov highlight the class, I would say, all due respect to Phil Housley. I think those three players are on another level when you look at their entire careers. If you were, you had to pick Pronger or Lidstrom. You got to start your team with one of them. Which one are you taking?
We have to break it down first. I mean, I think it's interesting, Drew. I think the default would probably be Lidstrom. And it's hard to argue with that. Pronger's the interesting one because he starts in Hartford, you know, gets dealt by Jimmy Rutherford mm-hmm. to St. Louis for Shanahan.
Yeah, for Brendan Shanahan. Can you imagine if that trade was made today?
Yeah, I know. The world would explode. Twitter would explode.
Wouldn't be any journalism written about it, though.
That's right. That's for sure. So, I mean, his career with the Blues was a good, really good career. And he made them one of the top teams. He goes to Edmonton for a year, takes them to the Stanley Cup final. They lose in Game 7. If they don't have the goaltending injury, maybe they do win.
Mm-hmm.
I had an Edmonton executive say to me years ago that when they lost him, they spent 5 to 6 more minutes a night in their own zone because they didn't have Chris Pronger anymore. Then he moves over to Anaheim. They win the Cup. So now he's been in two finals with two different franchises. Then he goes to Philly when he's older.
Mm-hmm.
Goes to the Cup final, loses in Game 6 in a great series against Chicago Blackhawks.
And that if they have NHL-quality goaltending, then maybe they win that series. They don't have Michael Layton as their starter.
Sure. So you look at it and you say, well, I mean, the guy went to the cup final with three different teams. Surely that can't be a coincidence. With Lidstrom, it's kind of like the Belichick Brady thing. I mean, you never saw him with anybody else. They've been so brilliant. Certainly, you know, they're brilliant. Would they be brilliant apart? Would he be brilliant if he wasn't on Detroit? I think he would have been. So I still say Lidstrom, but I think it's awfully close. I really do. I think Chris Pronger was a mean but dominant defenseman. Both were capable of playing a ton of minutes, and I know the book that we talked about with Michael Farber has Pronger a little bit down on the list. I think Pronger is probably in the top five or six of all time.
You know, Richie mentions Chris Pronger in 2006, his one season with Edmonton. Yeah. One of the Chris Pronger memories that stands out for me is game one of that series, that final series against Carolina. Game one, he takes a penalty shot. He's the first player ever to take a penalty shot in a Stanley Cup Finals. Nicholas Wallin covered up the puck, if you remember.
Yeah, with his glove in the crease.
And Chris Pronger scores on Cam Ward. And I agree with Richie. I think Chris Pronger, you could argue he was the Conn Smythe winner that year, even though the Edmonton Oilers didn't win and Carolina won. But it's such a great argument to have, Drew, because you're talking about two of the most dominant defensemen of the last 20 years, right? And they're completely different, right?
That's what's so interesting.
Nicholas Lidstrom is better offensively, and he controlled the play in a different way than Chris Pronger. Chris Pronger controlled it in more of a physical fashion. If you came in front of the net, whether it was on St. Louis or Edmonton or Anaheim, Chris Pronger was going to put his Sherwood in the back of your neck, right? You were scared to go in front of the net with Chris Pronger. 6 foot six, 200-plus pounds. I mean, he was a scary guy. He could also hurt you offensively. I mean, he won the Hart Trophy with St. Louis in 2000, right? Defensemen just don't do that very often. So I would take Lidstrom over Pronger, Richie, but if you're talking about two defensemen that young defensemen should model their games after, I would say Nicholas Lidstrom one, and sure, there's some other good defensemen there as well, but Chris Pronger. And Chris Pronger, I don't think, gets appreciated enough sometimes, even though he's in the Hall of Fame, obviously, for how good offensively he was. I mean, he could blast the shot from the point. He was a great passer, too, a superb passer.
Great but first pass.
Nicholas Lidstrom, you're talking about a guy who, and Pronger could play a lot, too, but Lidstrom, you're talking about a guy who played the game at such a high level for so long in a different way than anybody else. I mean, Chris Pronger was good defensively. Nicholas Lidstrom, it was tough to ever get any type of positioning on him. The way he used his body, because people forget he was a big guy too, 6 foot three. He was a pretty good defensive defenseman as well, but he had the ability to quarterback the power play too. So both of those defensemen, I agree with you, Drew, that's the creme de la creme of the 2015 Hall of Fame class.
Let's shelve our conversation about Sergei Fedorov versus Eric Lindros until Saturday's program.
Sure.
That gives me an excellent segue to remind you of the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, 12 noon on Saturday, as we get you set for the Jets and the Predators. Big thanks to tonight's guest, Craig Ludwig, Dallas Stars analyst, and Sports Illustrated and from TSN, Michael Farber, joining us. In case you missed either of those, they're available for download on iTunes, on tsn1290.ca, and of course on our website, illegalcurve.com. Big thanks to our sponsors, Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club, Linden Market Dental Center, Bernstein's Deli, Zappia Group Realty, the Jewish Foundation of Manitoba, Keener Jerseys, and Royal Sports. For my colleagues, Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg, I'm your host, Drew Mandel. Big thanks to producer Rory and producer Chris. Until Saturday at 12 noon, we wish you good night and good luck, and thanks for listening to NHL This Week.